U.S. and in Canada. So we don't have a sort of panel presentation kind of planned out. I think that each of us will make a few opening comments. And the subtitle is How Community Radio Stations Engage with Media Democracy Issues. What is our interest has to play in gaining the kind of media democracy that will support an actual democracy in the U.S. and in Canada. So we don't have a sort of panel presentation kind of planned out. I think that each of us will make a few opening comments. But I really hope that this becomes like sort of more of a conversation that folks who are actually making radio, making public affairs radio, which at the moment is not including any of the three of us, actually, are kind of uniquely placed to talk about what are the opportunities that stations have to talk about what might be considered political advocacy. You know, it's just an uncomfortable subject for some station managers, if not station public affairs producers. And so what are the opportunities for us to do advocacy around issues that are of such crucial importance to us? One thing that I've noticed definitely within the community radio environment over the past couple of years is that it's the one place where kind of a general taboo against doing advocacy on particular issues for a station as representing itself, like the station's promo, the station's own educational materials, where it's putting out its own kind of identity behind issues. The place where that becomes not taboo is in places where the station feels like its existence is sort of threatened. So the primary example in the last couple of years I can think about in terms of policy discussions was digital copyright, the DCMA, and related issues, where stations that you would never hear, like a political advocacy ad around any other kind of congressional bill happening, you were hearing frequent ads telling people not vote the bum out of office, but saying, go to this website and learn all you can about this important issue, and please, you know, contact your congressman and senator to tell them what you think about this important issue. That was kind of a coming out for a lot of stations, putting DCMA-related website materials on their site or leading people to advocacy sites. I think that media democracy issues, which we'll kind of talk about some of those this morning, are a natural for stations to kind of come out of the closet a little bit more and do advocacy around these issues. Because it's not just the self-existence, the self-preservation of low-power FM stations and community radio having our slice of the radio dial, and our freedom to serve our communities on the internet and so forth that are impacted by media democracy and media policy debates in the U.S. and Canada. But more importantly, it's our listeners' access to free information that's at stake. One of the ways that Reclaim the Media in general is pursuing talking about media policy over the looking ahead to the next year or so is we're always fighting the good fight as the FCC is attempting to roll back the media ownership limits, or the Senate Republicans are trying to impose a new telecommunications regulation regime that will not have network neutrality provisions that protect our freedom of access to different kinds of materials on the internet. We're also looking forward to thinking about not just how can we stop them from choking us to death, but rather how can we begin to articulate what kind of progressive media policy regime do we want? What kind of media world do we want to live in, and what are the kind of what should these regulations about how our media works or for us? What would those rules look like? If they were written from the ground up, not to serve the interests of money, corporations, and elites, but rather the people and those who are voiceless in society to guarantee that kind of access. So, and I think that community radio has a unique role to play in our in its ability to, you know, get people's imagination thinking and you know, imagining in a positive way what the world is that we want to live in. I'm going to invite, let's see, 9:25. I'm going to invite Petrie and Sharon, if they want to introduce a couple of, this is a question I'm going to ask y'all to respond to. What are the current media policy debates or topics that are happening right now, or not just policy focus, but the current issues in the realm of media democracy that are sort of coming before us as a society in the next, say, 6 months, that there's a particular role for community media to respond to? And I'll ask Petrie to start. He's working on Low Power FM right now, for one.
Okay.
Do that.
There's right now the political situation at the commission. Obviously, we have a 3-2 majority of Republicans at the moment, and a still Republican-controlled Congress, Republican-controlled White House, and most of the courts these days as well. But we're coming off of a...
Pause for 1 second, and just for everyone's benefit, if somebody uses a term or an acronym that you understand, please stop us. Because of the commission is the FCC. Go ahead.
And we're coming out of a situation where, and it's, this has been the case for several years, and so an overwhelmingly deregulatory sort of an attitude has been working through the communications policy for the past couple of years. But it is pretty incredible that in spite of having all of these advantages, the last FCC chairman was actually unable to push his agenda through of allowing corporations to merge like crazy. And there was such a large citizens movement that we actually did manage to stop a very large wave of media mergers from going through. That debate, obviously we lost at the commission in 2003, then we got the lawsuit that prevented the FCC from implementing the rules that it wanted to implement. And then, now we're about to start that up, and the comment period is going on right now. Now, what happened was the judge in that case ordered the FCC to go back, and they said that the basis that you used was completely irrational for making this decision. You did not, you failed to justify the new rules, and so, most Americans don't really realize this, but back 30, 40 years ago, a couple of really good rules were passed. And basically they said that if you're the owner of a television station, you can't also own the radio stations in town. If you're the owner of radio stations, you can't own the TV, you can't own the newspapers. And there was a series of structural rules, is what they called them, because even though the government wasn't going to tell people you could say this or you can't say this on the radio, they did make sure that there was a diversity of ownership and so that there would be some competition. Now, the FCC former chairman Michael Powell was trying to sweep away all of these rules, and he called for a series of empirical studies by mediaologists who would figure out whether there was really any danger to our democracy from having, let's say, one person own the cable network, three TV stations, eight radio stations, the two competing daily newspapers, all the billboards, and maybe the nuclear power plant down the road, too. Whether there was any danger to society from allowing that kind of scenario to happen. He tapped a number of scholars to study this question using various economic measures and all that sort of thing. And at the end of the day, he decided, no problem, no big deal. And mostly what he said was, the internet's going to fix everything for us, and we don't need to worry about it, and it doesn't matter if someone owns all that stuff, because there's always, you can have a website, and that'll just sort of fix everything. Some real interesting stuff has come out in the past couple of days, and There were over 3 million comments that were put out by the public in opposition to this plan. He waved those all aside. He said that we were fear-mongers, that we were unscientific, that he wasn't going to make his decisions based on emotions, and, you know, lots of hysterical people complaining about things that they didn't really understand. And that he was going to make his decision based on rational, policy, evidence-based rulemaking. Well, the amazing thing that's come out in the past couple of days is that he commissioned a study to see whether local ownership creates more local news coverage. And what is remarkable about that study was, you know, he thought it was going to come out the other way. But in fact, local TV station owners actually make about 5 more minutes of news per day, according to this study of over 4,000, you know, selected pieces over a long period of time. And it was actually a very significant effect that proves exactly the opposite, that local ownership does in fact promote local news coverage. So when that study was about to come to light, he ordered it shredded, because it would undermine the entire basis of everything that he was saying in public. And so while he was accusing us of fear-mongering and being unscientific Luddites, he was actually taking the evidence that came in front of him and destroying it so that it would never, you know, so that the public would never see it. This just came to light about 3 or 4 days ago. We don't know how many of the commissioners actually saw this before it was shredded. Entirely possible that the current chairman could have seen it, Chairman Martin. So it's kind of an interesting moment. It seems that on the one hand, the commission is proceeding full steam ahead, trying to get these rules taken apart again. On the other hand, there seems like there's a lot of momentum from the last time. The thing that was most effective was actually the organizing that went across ideology. There were 3 million comments, but I got to tell you, they weren't 3 million comments from the left. Like, over 1 million of those came from the National Rifle Association. How that happened, don't even ask me. All kinds of people claim credit for getting them to do this, but I don't know that we're necessarily going to get them again, because the political conservative establishment is very good at, you know, reining its people in. So we are up for a really big fight over the next probably like 60, 90 days of comment period, and then the next, you know, 6-month window when this is going to try to play itself out.
Which commissioner was that ordered the study?
This was Powell, ordered it destroyed.
Chairman
Powell. And Commissioner Martin is now the chairman. He claims never to have seen the study.
How did it come out?
One of the guys that did it left the commission, started, you know, got himself a nice little tenured teaching job, and was like, "Hey, everybody, I did this study." So that's a big one. I'll also say what's going on with the Power FM right now.
Can you pass up a couple of waters, please, Karen?
Yeah.
Low power radio, it was started by the commission in 2000, was drastically limited by an act of Congress, and of course Congress always trumps the commission in terms of power, so we went from having stations in every major market except for 3. There were 25 stations in the top 10 urban markets according to the commission's rules, and then Congress drastically limited that so that there were no radio stations available in the top 50 urban markets. There is a bill to repeal that very damaging act of Congress that's sponsored by Maria Cantwell, by John McCain, and by Patrick Leahy. And so there's, we actually passed the comics committee in 14-7. We got endorsed by the Christian Coalition, which
they want radio stations.
Yeah, they want radio stations, and so it has some exciting prospects. We never really thought that we could pass it under this Congress, but the Christian Coalition is helping out a little bit, the endorsement. I mean, they're not doing anything. They just said they like it. But that was enough to sway. We got votes from, like, Trent Lott. and Vitter from Louisiana. All these crazy people that, you know... I'm sorry, I'm going to digress for a second. When you go into Trent Lott's office, there is something on the wall. There's this needlepoint that is up there, and it says, "I try to be humble, but I'm from Mississippi." but he voted for us, which is incredible. But what we were added to was on this incredibly crappy bill. And this is the first thing I learned about Washington is that no bill passes by itself. Everything is like 40 things lumped onto each other. So we got tacked on as an amendment to this really atrocious bill that basically the idea is to give the internet away to Comcast and Verizon. So we were in the uncomfortable position of, you know, they wanted to add us to this bill, and of course, you don't say no to an opportunity to, like, jump onto a moving bill. But on the other hand, we don't want that bill to pass or anything. It was basically a sort of a litmus test of support for Low Power Radio. So we passed that, we're tacked onto that. In the House, we're hoping to get tacked onto a different bill, and hopefully we'll end up on, you know, riding that train rather than the Motherfucker Communication Act of 2007. That other bill is what's called the WARN Act, and it's born out of the desire to do something about Katrina. A lot of politicians really need to have done something about Katrina, especially in the wake of the utter failure of politicians to do anything about Katrina at the time that was going on. So what this act is, it's actually a pretty good bill. It's one of the few bills that's passing Congress right now that I wouldn't mind being on. And what it does is the most important upshot is that it will force the cell phone companies to add emergency alert capabilities to cell phones. Essentially what I'll do is, you know, at the same time as the emergency broadcast network, the emergency alert system, is like notifying people on the radio, like your cell phone will get a text message saying, there's a tornado coming. So it just like extends the emergency alert capability in times of emergency. There's worse things they could do with their money than that. So we're hoping to get tacked onto that bill, basically on the rationale that Low Power FM actually is another way of bringing emergency information, localized, neighborhood by neighborhood emergency information, and because we're less likely to be run by computers from someone that's, you know, over in San Antonio, Texas, we're more likely to convey live, local, important news. You know, it's sort of one thing if it's Katrina, but there could be a tornado that nobody in San Antonio knows about that low power people would report on and be active and engaged in. So, based on the emergency services rationale, we're trying to get attached to that bill. We're going to see how that goes. That's a lot.
I got a concept lost. I'm like, what is it exactly that you're getting tacked on to that bill now?
What we're trying to get tacked on is legislation that will repeal the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act of 2000. And that what that Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act does is it takes away roughly 3/4 of the frequencies that are known to be viable for low power FM and it's Congress instructing the FCC not to give away those frequencies. So we're trying to repeal that act, which would create a... Am I up to a triple or quadruple negative yet? if Congress repeals that act, then the FCC will be allowed to let those frequencies out, and there'll be a lot more low-power radio stations, probably about, you know, three or four times as many as there are today.
What was the year of that one?
2000.
And what was it called?
Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act.
One of those Orwellian bill titles.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Communications Act that's going through the Senate. Given that radio and the internet are going to be merging more in coming years, talk a little bit about net neutrality.
Can we segue?
Yeah.
Let's go to Sharon.
Can I ask a follow-up question before we go off?
Okay.
Which is, how would we learn which markets that might be available to low-power FM if indeed this were to pass? So that we can, like, say, go to our Congress people and say, this is going to affect our communities specifically.
We have an expert here this weekend, engineer Michael Brown.
Yeah.
You can ask about your own locations about that.
Well, he's looking at low power FM because of the spectrum being opening up in spring or summer of next year.
What I would just basically say is that if the full package of reforms that we're asking for were implemented, basically there would be low power stations available just about anywhere. As a result of some changes in the ways that we want preference to be granted to translators versus low power FM. So it's relevant to everyone. Now, if you ask me the actual chances of winning low power stations for everywhere, I would have to like kind of cross my fingers, you know, and hope a lot. But, so, you know, I don't want to say your community is definitely going to get a low power radio station if this passes. But if the full package of what we're asking for was passed, that's what would happen.
I have a question also. Is there any way that it's attached to the COPA, right? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Is there any way, first of all, to get that separated, and second of all, because the COPA is really awful, I will not work for it. I will work against it. So if I work against the COPA, does that mean I'm also killing this other piece?
No, yeah, it's like a game of Frogger, like, where, like, you know, you attach a little thing and it jumps on this thing, and then, you know, it goes a little and jumps on that thing, you know. So, work against the COPAC.
Okay.
Let's go to Sharon, because I think these questions do touch on a lot of things, and we want to talk about net neutrality a little bit.
Yeah, I want Jonathan to talk more specifically about net neutrality. But I want to just say one thing about community radio. You never know who's listening to you. In the Clinton administration, there was a guy named Bill Kennard who was the chairman of the FCC. And while we had a lot of problems with certain things he did, one of the things he did was open up LCFM. And part of why he did this is as a child, he listened. He told me he was kind of a loner as a teenager. And so he sat in his bedroom and he listened to KPFK Pacifica Radio, and he learned about the world from that.
Wow.
And so you never know who was listening to you. And he made me promise during the whole time he was in the Clinton administration not to tell anybody that he was the Pacifica listener. And then there was another person in the Clinton administration, Jeff Cowan, who was the head of Voice of America. And he was a KPFK board member and a progressive attorney from Los Angeles. He was a legacy. His father had been head of the Voice of America back when it first started. And he opened up the kind of programming that went across Voice of America, including acquisition of some Pacifica programming and some programming from independent producers that addressed issues of racism, of gender, of homophobia, and other kinds of issues that they actually streamed on Voice of America. So you never know who you're impacting when you do your programming.
Wow, that's great, Sharon.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we just know all these things, but there are people, and I hear these stories all the time from people who listen. On net neutrality, I want to talk a little bit about the global issue of internet access, because we tend to think of our own access on our home computers, our office computers, but the vast majority of the world, individuals do not own computers. And in Manila and Nairobi, everybody has their own email address. They do not have computers. So they go to these cyber cafes, and it's the lifeline not only to their family, but the lifeline to get information about things around the world. And they have to use a Yahoo or Gmail or whatever. They have to get a free one because their economy is totally different from ours, and they couldn't afford even, you know, like an AOL membership. The net neutrality issue is even more critical in many ways for people around the world than it is for us. It's bad enough for us, but those folks around the world, have the so-called developing world, they have no say in this at all. And we have the power in community radio to get the word out about this issue, to get more than 3 million responses, to use the Soweto type of example of getting people to go after Congress. And I hate the idea that Maria Cantwell is a co-sponsor of this thing. Does that mean we have to vote for her here in Washington?
I didn't say that.
Many of us are not going to vote for her in Congress.
She got a great aide, which is, you know, unusual.
Congressional staff people, by the way, that's the way in. You've got to know somebody on the staff, and they all come from somewhere in your hometown or whatever. If you can get to one staff person, that makes all the difference in the world.
Is there a name or a number on the legislation?
I'm sorry, which legislation?
The one that Pete's talking about, I'm sorry.
Senate Bill 310, 312, and I can't remember the other one.
So I just want to emphasize how important all of your roles are, wherever you are, whether you're an engineer or a manager or a music producer. Hey, doesn't the music audience need to know this as much as the news audience? You can't assume that people are listening all day and all night to your station. One of the big things that always used to upset me at community radio is this sort of concept that, you know, we have the correct information, so we're going to, like, tell you. But you're not paying attention enough to the lifestyle of who could be your audience. You know, a one-hour program where they only announce the guests at the beginning of the program. It just drives me crazy. You know, somebody's driving along and they hear 10 minutes of it and they're really excited. But who is this person? You know, they don't know. Make it accessible. Talk to your music audience as well as your public affairs and news audience and make sure they know about this. This is something that impacts all of us, but it impacts the rest of the world way, way more. It's a lifeline for people around the world, and they have no idea that these kind of policies are coming down the line. And Jonathan can talk more about the specifics of the legislation, but I'll just say one more thing. In late October, we don't know for sure the exact date, there is going to be here in Seattle an FCC hearing. And this is a chance to get your audience prepared. You've got a month, or a little over a month. If you're anywhere in the Northwest, it's going to be the only one in the Northwest. Have people caravan, get on the bus, whatever, and come testify. This is going to be crucial to get a big showing for that.
I thought it was October 28th.
There's on the back of the program guide, it claims that it's on October 28th. But there's a typo in there that also says that it's October 26th. And actually, that was like actually somehow constantly represented that we don't know which of those dates it's going to be on. But Reclaim the Media will know that. Also, our friends in Portland are also trying to get an official hearing there.
What was the hearing before?
The hearing is, the FCC has a media ownership proceeding open right now. They're accepting comments because they're going to review the media ownership rules, which means that the FCC leadership is going to try to destroy or weaken the media ownership rules. He's pledged to hold 6 official public hearings, but has only scheduled 1 to date. As in 2003, the Democratic commissioners, Jonathan Alstein and Michael Copps, are traveling around scheduling their own public hearings to make sure that the public has a chance to speak. They've done one in Milwaukee, they're doing one in Oakland, and they're going to do one here and possibly elsewhere.
I have a D.C. contact who was in Milwaukee last week and would have the information needed to contact to track that down.
Great. Actually, Reclaim the Media is sponsoring the Seattle hearing. So,
okay.
Yeah. So when as soon as we have a date nailed down, it will be on the RTM site, and we'll try to make everyone else aware of that now. One thing, and I'll talk a little bit about net neutrality and what's happening with these bills right now, and what I think what I think is going to happen over the next few months, and we can have a conversation. One thing that was true definitely about the media ownership battle, and it's kind of generally true about policy changes that affect big media institutions, which, by the way, like big media and big telecommunications interests are like pretty easily the most high-dollar, high-expenditure lobbies in D.C., like bigger than any other industry you can think of. And they spend a lot of money, and they get their money's worth usually buying off politicians. And so it takes 3 million comments to get people's attention. And, you know, we're doing it because this is not like some sort of Communist Party petition we're talking about. This is like apple pie. You know, when people find out about the issues, they're pretty much automatically on the correct side of the issue, and they're pissed off about it. The problem is finding out about getting information out about the issues. Not surprisingly, given the interest at stake, media policy issues, particularly issues affecting media ownership, are a huge blind spot for mainstream news coverage. During the 2003 media ownership debates, we have two newspapers in Seattle, which is really rare already. The Seattle Times, owned by, you know, a little more than half owned by a family who really are trembling in their boots because although they're a big, bad media company, they're like a tiny fish compared to much bigger media companies, and they really want the media rules to stay the way they are. That paper editorialized in favor of keeping the media rules. The other paper in town is owned by the Hearst Corporation, and they editorialized, I mean, amazing they even mentioned the fact there was a debate, but they editorialized in favor of getting rid of the media ownership rules. In their editorial, they said, well, we realize there may be the appearance of a conflict of interest here, but this is just too important. We have to weigh in on the side of the people. You know, it was kind of crazy. But this is how, it was amazing that they actually even mentioned there was a debate at all. If you hear anything at all, it's usually on like page 10 of the business section where no one can really. Yeah.
Very briefly, the friend I mentioned in D.C., I was in D.C. last week and lunch with him. He estimates that the communications companies have spent $200 million so far trying to get this passed.
And, yeah, I mean, and to sort of transition into the net neutrality issue for a moment, I mean, when the issue was hot and heavy before the House and then the Senate Commerce Committee, we estimated that they were spending, like, upwards of $1.5 million a week just on, you know, on lobbying and on TV ads targeting, you know, electors, you know, electoral elected officials in D.C. So, yeah.
Right when we were segueing into digital, you mentioned trying to separate in the repeal translators versus actual power FM. Does that speak to the AM people who will maybe be looking at using FM frequencies if that does get
reviewed? Oh, you are really up on that. Yeah, totally.
Wait a minute, repeat the question.
Right now, there is a petition at the FCC to allow AM radio stations to be able to use FM frequencies to repeat their channels. Mm-hmm. And basically, the rationale is AM stations, it's like the first radio technology, kind of clunky, doesn't work so good actually, and the station owners, they're really having a hard time financially and so forth. And so, okay, so that's one side of it. The other side is there are these channels that are called translators, and what they do is they repeat the signals of full power broadcasters. And basically, they were given that right back in like 1970 or so, because everyone thought that FM was so worthless, and particularly small signal FM channels were so worthless, that, you know, you just might as well just give them out to to existing broadcasters to extend their signals. Now, as the FM band has become more successful and more dense, it's turning out that these translator frequencies are actually really worth something, and we are trying to get the use of them for community radio. But of course, like anything that's free from the government, there's lots of people that want things free from the government. So we would like them. These giant religious satellite networks would like them because they create, you know, there was one of them, Radio Assist Ministry, that applied for 4,000 of these translators across the country, which would make them have like three times more radio stations than Clear Channel. Except that they're all like between, you know, 50 and 250 watts, and they're just like peppered in everywhere. Our request to the FCC is to say, wait a second, these things are not worthless. Don't just throw them out. Don't just give them away to one guy in Twin Falls, Idaho. Give community groups that want to do community programming first access to these channels. That's what we say. You know, Mr. Twin Falls, Idaho is saying, well, I applied for them and, you know, they're mine, you know, you missed the boat. So that's another person that wants them. Of course, the existing FM stations like to keep on getting them, so NPR is like, no, we want them all, you know. So, you know, don't give them to the LPFM people, don't give them to the... And now the AM people are like, well, wait, we want them too. So there's an enormous battle over these, you know, 200... like up to 200 watt radio stations that everybody knows doesn't create interference, but it's currently like a big, you know, it's a big car wreck in Washington over these things that the FCC continues to think. It's like, oh, what, you know, I don't know, we'll just, you know, throw them out there and whoever grabs them. They're not. Right now that petition is live. I don't know which way the FCC is going to go on it. That's a question of how much political.
Okay, so that's not what you're addressing when you're describing.
Well, we'd like those channels.
Okay.
We'd like the translator channels. We think that the best way to do it is that if an organization pledges to do a given amount of local programming, that they should get the highest priority, and then. If there is an organization that wants to do that, they should just be open for repeaters. We're pretty opposed to the AM stations getting them because the AM stations are all commercial, and if it's commercial, then they have to get auctioned, and if it's an auction, then you know, then the prices are going to be like, you know, millions of dollars for like these 200 watt radio stations, and it's going to be out of our reach again.
Okay, can you just briefly recap again what's their argument? Because the way I heard it, they were saying, well, digital technology is making it.
Actually, I think we should. We're a little short on time, so
okay.
I think we should.
Yeah,
move, but
okay.
We should,
I can certainly.
Yeah.
Go
answer.
Okay.
One thing that's related to the availability of radio station of new radio frequencies is that there's an upcoming full power window for non-commercial educational stations. And we're not talking about that right now, but Todd and Sakura are doing a presentation, which is not on the schedule at the right time now. It's actually tomorrow morning, I think at 10, although we'll make an announcement later when people who know about what time it is better than I do will say. But that will be an interesting session for folks who want to learn about another opportunity for new stations to come online. We had brought up net neutrality, I haven't really said much about it. Let me just ask, before I launch into something in the last few minutes here, I don't know which way to do this, positive or negative, but who has heard the term net neutrality but doesn't really understand totally well what that refers to? Okay, that's enough people that we should definitely, yeah, I know, me too. So there's this big, bad telecommunications bill, which was called the Cope bill in the House. It stands for something Orwellian and crazy, it doesn't matter. And in the Senate, it has some other name. He's sponsored by Ted Stevens in Alaska. It's a few good things and many, many bad things. The bad things, I'll name three in particular, that are easily enough to work to kill this bill by themselves. One of them is that... the bill would sort of reify telecom companies' ability to redline, which means if they're going to deploy cable and telephone services in a given area, they have the ability to cherry pick, okay, we're going to go and give cable to these rich people, but it wouldn't really be as lucrative for us to serve this poor neighborhood, so screw them. We should make that totally against the law. This bill totally ignores a chance to do that, and so it allows for racist redlining. The second thing it does is it would, in ways that are too complicated to go into right now, it would really strip away funding and other resources for local community television, public access television, and it'll be a terrible bill for community access. The third thing is what we're calling net neutrality. All the focus is on that because people like us who work on media activism have identified that as the most politically potent place to kill this bill. Net neutrality is, in short, the principle that when I go online and I want to look at democracynow.org, that site should come to my computer as fast as if I want to look at CNN, Fox News, screwupyourlife.com. And those things, there shouldn't be a fast lane and a slow lane, in other words. That Fox News should not have the opportunity or the ability to pay Comcast $1 billion in order for their site to come faster to me than their competitor site. That distinction becomes a lot more important as more of us are getting, not me personally, but over the next few years, we're going to be getting TV, phone services, etc., through the same exact wires and the same internet protocols that we're getting our internet stuff on as well. And so the question of whether all this content is treated equally is very important. Up until recently, the way that internet content was treated was exactly analogous to the way that telephone calls come in. Like, for example, I get my phone service from Quest. Quest is not legally permitted to treat one company's call to me from somewhere else differently from another one. They can't, like, make it, easier for me to or have a higher quality signal from my parents than from somebody in another part of the country because it's all neutral. That is no longer the case for the internet. It's sort of like a gray area. This law is going to decide whether this kind of neutrality is written into an internet regulation or not. So the people that are in favor of getting rid of this sort of neutral rules are Comcast, AT&T, and a very small handful of big-ass internet providers. People who are opposed to that are, any interest group that has consumer interest in mind, plus a lot of the big companies who don't want to have to shell out big bucks to make sure that their signal gets to you. And that includes Amazon.com, CNET, Microsoft, all these providers of content. They don't want to have to pay a bribe to Comcast to get access to your thing. That's what the issue is.
I understand why they would really be motivated, Comcast and bigger companies like that, why they would be motivated to do that. But what are their PR reasons? What are they telling the public? Like, why is it a good thing?
Their PR reasons are that, it's free speech. They have the right to. They're also saying that it's a consumer benefit, that consumers should have access to they should be able to pay. People should be able to pay to ensure that their signal gets through clear. And also they're saying, which is as ridiculous a thing as you can imagine, that if they don't have the ability to charge more money to people who are sending stuff over the internet, then they won't have any motivation to, improve their lines.
Let's go the other way also, where consumers might be asked to pay in order to get certain signals faster.
Well, that's not the way it's likely to happen. You have the option to pay for this fast of a pipe into your house, or for this much speed or capacity, and that's has nothing to do with this at all. This is like how much you. Unless you or yourself are providing content over the internet.
Well, I was meaning that I'd say, hey, in order to get NBC or whatever thing faster than CBS.
The pricing would get passed on to you one way or another, no doubt about it.
If this bill passed, would it control not just the speed with which you were able to access certain websites, but also whether you could get it at all, especially in some of the countries you were talking about, like Manila or some of the places where people are going to cyber.
for people in those countries is that they are paying by the minute to be on the computer. So the slower it is, the less they're going to have an opportunity to even communicate. I mean, they go typically, an average person in the Philippines or in Kenya or places like that that has an email address or uses the internet, they typically go like maybe a half hour a week. That's like the max they can afford to go. So, you know, that has a huge difference to their capacity to be able to do anything.
Yeah, another part of the answer to that really good question is that, yeah, net neutrality would disallow Comcast or whoever from, like, treating one piece of content different from another, both in terms of speeding up or slowing it down, or in terms of banning it. If there are no net neutrality protections, then AOL or whoever, there's no law that stops them from blocking access to indymedia.org, for example, or anything they want. And you would never know for sure. And already we have seen several instances of, you know, certain sites being blocked. I forget exactly. I think there was an AOL thing where somebody put up a stop AOL website or something for testing them.
AOL.com, and it was about the spam blockers they wanted to do. Like, they wanted to charge matters and cents per email or something like that. They started this campaign. And DearAOL.com was a campaign launched against AOL doing this email, and it got blocked. Like, all emails from there got blocked.
So the question is, do we want to live in a world where that's, like, commonplace?
And it's important to realize that the internet is the way that it is now. Every new communications technology gets a new regulatory regime at the FCC. So they treat AM radio different than they treated FM radio, and they treat that different from television. They treat that different from cable and so on, which creates a lot of, like, weird imbalances. But, for example, when they started the phone system, they said, okay, obviously the phones are going to be a monopoly. But in exchange for you having the monopoly and controlling all of the wires between everybody's houses, you have to do a couple things. First, you have to provide universal service. So even poor people should be able to have phones. And, you know, at least they should, you know, even if they can't pay their bill at all, they should have a phone, they should be able to call 911 in an emergency. And so the phone company was like, okay, I guess there's some, like, things that you just have to take with being big. And, like, okay, we'll give that, you know. And they also said, okay, look, if you're the phone company, we'll have this idea called common carrier, which means that if you want to make a phone call to you, you know, you can make the phone call. And even if you are calling to talk shit about, you know, a company that the phone company also owns, like, they're, let's say the phone company also owns Universal Studios, and you want to call and say, God, that movie... you know, Titanic, that really sucked. You know, the phone company cannot say, you can't say that over our phone line, right? And that's enshrined in law. The difference with net neutrality is, and the reason the internet developed the way it did is because it started by going over the phone line. But now the phone, you know, now the internet is going over the cable line. And cable is regulated differently. The model of cable is not you have a cable and you can put a program on and send it to him and he can send a program over to her. The model is we're the cable company. We choose the 50 channels for you. You can get a package of 50 channels or 100 channels, but we choose them. And we get to you know, decide what's on there. There's no common carrier in cable regulation. And so... that's why if it's the cable companies that are starting to provide internet, all of a sudden the internet character can change. And right now they don't do that. You know, the cable companies provide you the same cable like internet as everyone else. But as they get more market dominance, as they have less competition, they start having different business incentives and they can start using and controlling the shape of the internet in ways that we can't really see today. So
I would also add that the history of every communications technology, at least going back to AM radio, has started out more egalitarian, and as the regulatory regime developed, it's become more restrictive.
Yeah.
That's happening now with internet also.
I think we're about out of town. time. If
actually,
you're like,
I have until 10:30.
Oh, until 10:30? Oh, okay. Well, I'll say it anyway. if you're like me and are sort of overwhelmed by all the different regulatory things that are happening and don't have time to study it in an intense way, go to Prometheus's website, which is
PrometheusRadio.org.
PrometheusRadio.org and Reclaim the Media, which is ReclaimTheMedia.org. And they have summaries of all of this. You know, that's what I do. Once a week, I check the site because I just don't have time to do the rest of it. And it's a great, great resource to keep your producers and everybody up to date, you know, print it out and have that be in an announcement that, you know, gets read frequently.
We're on your networks now. Soon, next week, we can post our news stories that we've already been producing on these shows.
Great, yeah.
And then you can plan.
Right.
It's organizations like ours, and that's a good sort of segue into this briefly, is there are a growing number of organizations who are coming out of social movement networks, but focusing specifically on media policy matters that are grassroots organizations that have roots in local communities and kind of organizationally analogous to community stations or other sort of social justice, environmental organizations that we, as radio people, commonly work with. Prometheus is based in Philly. There are other organizations in Philadelphia and San Francisco and so forth. Reclaim the Media has kind of had a kind of regional focus because we were the only ones out here. But now there's a group in Bellingham that's working on these things. There's a new group in Tacoma. There's a group that's been starting up over the last couple of years in Oregon called Oregon ARM, the Oregon Alliance to Reform the Media, which is a really fabulous coalition of folks that grew out of organizing a localism hearing in Portland in 2004. So these are groups that usually actually are based in community radio, in part, just like the group of the media is, and we're ready to partner with stations who want to figure out a way to promote these debates.
If anyone is here from Oregon, I just heard a couple days ago that Senator Gordon Smith has come out against net neutrality, whereas Wyden is in favor of net neutrality, and I'd like to organize and that network of people to figure out how we're going to affect them. Obviously, we'll be talking with Oregon ARM as well. So just please contact me on Amy.
Okay, Lewis and then Karen.
Is I understand that the Senate Commerce Committee sort of oversees the FCC, and the chairman of that is Ted Stevens, who...
Thanks very much for that, by the way.
Who, yes, he lives in my hometown, and we have the only local radio station there. He lives just down the street from us, actually, and was instrumental in... Somehow, I'm not sure, I think, we really don't know, we were pirates and we didn't divest ourselves of all of our, of any of our pirate board became illegal. But my point here is that we've got a small community of 2,000 people who, within a captive audience, and we have the ability that I've never taken advantage of to talk about these issues. We do a little bit, but not in a matter of advocacy, of talk to the senator the next time you see him at the local cafe. And it's a, sort of a conundrum because we have what we have. We expect that we're going to have it forever, that things are going to be going on just fine, and we sort of laugh at the senator for being so weird and not understanding things and have a problem with how we can educate. It's not just go vote yes or vote no, but it's truly the education part of it. How do you have it make sense to someone who describes the internet as it's not a dump truck that you can load things on, but a series of tubes that get clogged up with poker chips because everybody's playing online in their bathroom. that's what he thinks, really. So, and then we have, I have a friend here in his office in our town. He said the senator and my father were like political buddies when they grew up. And so there's this great resource here that I just really don't have access.
He's an incredibly powerful man.
Yeah.
I mean, basically because Alaska has the good sense to, like, just keep on re-electing and re-electing, and so he gets more and more senior. And so he's, like, he's basically in charge of, like, a huge amount of the United States economy, and he actually doesn't understand very much of it at all.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's really... The telecom lobbies have really, like, they've just been going, and I don't know how they managed to influence him, but they spend a lot of time with him. So, I mean, I think that you really, the way to most effectively reach people is that when they hear things from people that they trust and that they consider to, you know, have similar views from them. So, I mean, I think if your town just got to know a lot more about these issues, not necessarily by saying, you know, next time you see Chad, like, throw a brick at him or something like that, but
no, no, just the education.
Yeah, I mean, it is funny that we have the system that takes, like, kind of regular people and then just, like, sort of by their career choice and whatever propels them into this, like, these positions of incredible power, and you forget that not all of them are actually, like, really qualified or anything to be there. And they're just influenced the same way that you're influenced, you know?
Continuing on with this just for a moment, it would be interesting sort of educational for... I feel like I have the ability to be a conduit to you, and our radio station to be a conduit. And so I'd like to make new connections, educate me, and I can educate our staff, and they can educate the community.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You don't have to be, I mean, it's very dangerous for you to be a strong out-and-out advocate, because Ted Stevens will find a way to shut you down. He is now on this massive campaign against Senator Maria Cantwell here in Washington, which many of us don't like because of her stand on Iraq. But nevertheless, she stood up to him and dealt with the issue of the Alaska
oil
drilling. And so he, with his power, is pumping all kinds of money and getting favors from, you know, the top people in the White House and everything to all come and campaign on behalf of Maria Cantwell's Republican opponent. You know, this is not even his state. So his arms, tentacles reach out, and he's out to get her at all costs. She's a sitting senator. So, you know, you have to be careful, but I think the education is the key. You can air programs that were produced somewhere else. You can have debates, you can have discussion, you can raise the issue, ask the questions. You don't have to say that last bit about go do this.
Well, that's exactly. It's the education of the community and then the talk that is generated out of that.
And get some of the community stations elsewhere in Alaska to join forces with you.
Yeah, I'm part of another group of stations on the Central Mountains, South Central. Pretty new, and we've got translators that come back into Anchorage. We're going to get signals in Anchorage, so we've got them outside of Anchorage, and we've got translators in Anchorage. And then we have a little internet activity where we just stream around South Central Alaska so we can originate programming anywhere, and we do that.
If it's okay, I'd like to move on to a couple more questions. Karen, and then Jesus.
Well, I actually would like to make a statement and maybe have a little bit of debate with Sharon about this issue, because I think one of the things that's happening with Larry and I is that we're starting to figure out how to get into these congressional offices, how to start influencing congressional people, and there's a whole system to it. that you kind of have to figure out how the system works and how to work around it. And I'm happy to share that, but it's going to take me a couple minutes. And I think there is a way for you to be able to get to Ted Stevens and talk to him, but I don't know. I agree with you that Ted Stevens is a very powerful person. You don't want to make him an enemy. So, you know, you've got to really think about how you're going to play that. And if it's okay with you guys, I'd like to take a minute and just kind of talk about it, because it is actually easier than you think, but it takes time. And basically what's been happening is Larry and I have been working on the military law task force to get people who are not wanting to go to Iraq or not wanting to go back to Iraq to get them out, to get them discharged out of the military. And we have been finding that in every congressional office there's almost always a military liaison. And some of them are quite good and some of them are quite bad. And if you can start talking to the ones who are good, they can start using influence behind the scenes for you. Okay? And the way you start talking to them is you just call up that congressional office, you ask who is the person who deals with the issue that you're interested in talking to that particular congressional person about, you find out that staffer's name, and then you go and you try to talk to them. And like I said, what you're going to find is some of them are quite good and some of them are quite bad. Generally, congressional staffers get paid very little money. And so what they get are these kids who are fresh out of college, don't really know how to use the power of their office, don't really know how to be subtle about using the power of their office, and are often quite afraid if you call them up. So you just have to keep trying until you find the person who either is willing to take some chances with you or is willing to listen to you or whatever. And as long as you're patient and speak to them very respectfully, and you know, we've learned this whole system, like I said, of finding your way through the maze that is very hidden, that's underneath the congressional person. And that is the way that I have found that you then can educate the congressional person that you're trying to reach, because you have to educate at least one, if not up to 10, of their staffers first before you can actually get to the congressional person.
I don't disagree with that at all.
You do or
I don't.
Okay.
I was just trying to address his specific 2,000 people in the community issue.
But the thing is, if he then tries to go and approach Ted Stevens about this issue through this method I'm talking about, is that taking a chance on his radio station being attacked by Ted Stevens? I thought that was the implication of what you were saying. No? Did I misunderstand?
I was just talking about how you use the airwaves.
Okay.
All right. Okay, I've just been given the 5-minute high sign. So, it is.
Yeah. At the community radio, we had an issue recently this month, early this month. These Rancho people, and they're very powerful. They were going to put 200 cows within the city limits in Granger, where the radio station is. And it was something that was going to affect us. But we didn't want it to advocate in a way of being the leaders stopping this from happening. But what we did is we started looking for people that we didn't know were already in working on it and affected. And then we found those key people that sometimes we as a community radio don't know, and we assume we're a community radio, they should come to us, they don't. So we need to somehow try to find them and then use that people on the front line. You don't get in it. You don't say, okay, I'm going to go talk to the legislators. No, you send these people who they are already working there. All you do is you just connect them. I figure, you know, that's probably the best way to go. So, again, don't take it so serious that it's my responsibility. It is. But you use other people that is already there, and then you just help them and empower them with that education that you were talking about. Making it an issue and using people already in the community. And by the way, they don't have to work. So they are very strong.
Yeah, no, it's the same thing, but the question is the net neutrality bill, the COPE bill. COPE was the bill, that's the name of the bill in the Senate. In the House.
What is it?
COPE. It stands for
COPE.
But that bill is no longer in play. The House passed it several months ago. So now what is in play is the Senate bill, which has another name. I've been calling it the Stevens Telecom Bill. Petrie gave the number of it. I think actually in our program guide there is Leaf through that when you get a second. There's actually, in the back cover, there's some real quick and dirty action steps that we should take and encourage our listeners to take. And inside, there's actually a kind of more developed piece. It talks about what the media ownership debate this fall is about and what net neutrality is about. I think that will include the bill number there. Also, there's a very strong take action tool and website called SaveTheInternet.org. Also, I think .com, I think, works too. That was put together by a coalition of media democracy groups called the National Media, well, a coalition of groups that came together around this issue, including Free Press and Prometheus and Reclaim Media and a whole ton of other organizations. And that's probably the key resource on what's going on with these bills. I want to ask for final questions and then offer my co-panelists the final word also. Yeah.
I'd like to tie a couple things together with what you were talking about, what you said earlier, about coalitions in general. It's kind of strange bedfellows, like Christian groups, and you even mentioned the NRA. I think we should embrace that kind of thing and be careful about not making fun of other people and not showing prejudice. I think there's a lot of good people, a lot of Christians are good people, and a lot of NRA members, I know some nice people. On issues we can work together, we should, embrace these larger coalitions. That'll make us more powerful. I heard, I don't know if you're familiar with Paul Lowe, but he wrote a book called Soul of Citizen.
Yeah.
He talks about this kind of stuff. And he's like that. Evangelistic people tend to be real suspicious of big corporations.
Thank you for that comment, and we need to wrap up now, but please.
It's absolutely true. I've tried very hard to retrain myself to stop saying Christians, because it's we really need, Christianity is not like a single thing as interpreted by Jerry Falwell. It's just that he's very successfully managed to convince all of us that it is. And there are many, many different streams in it. We work very regularly with a lot of different Christian groups at this point, and the essential political project of the next 2 years to make sure that the world does not blow up is to separate out the Christian right from the corporate right, because they have this sort of unholy alliance. They actually have very little in common, but they've managed to elect people, to get their agendas through. And so, but their interests are actually completely incongruent in a lot of areas. So finding those issues that divide them, strengthening the progressive elements of Christianity as well, so that Christianity can't just be represented as, whatever Pat Robertson says it is, that's the key to making sure that the world doesn't blow up in the next 10 years.
Just one last thought. You've always heard the statement, without justice, there is no peace. Well, I would paraphrase that and say, without justice, there is no media democracy. So just try and keep that in mind.
This has been a great conversation. Let's give ourselves a hand.